Thanks for tuning in. From Municipal World, I'm Susan Gardner. This is the MW Shares podcast, where we share your stories, providing insights into the challenges and opportunities facing local governments and communities just like yours. This episode of MW Shares is sponsored by TELUS IoT and TELUS Smart Traffic Solutions. In part one, Ashley Whedon joined us to share her thoughts on the triumphs and failures of evidence-based policymaking, balancing individualism against the collective. Today, she discusses the dangers of a one-size-fits-all policy, gatekeeping and academic research, and how the rise in populism has affected local discourse.
I know we're down the rabbit hole. And I was just going to say, I don't want to take us further down the rabbit hole, but you know, when you talk about the failures of public policy to some extent to innovate and reinforcing the status quo, you know, it's kind of interesting that at this point where we're looking at evidence-based policy and making policy kind of one size fits all policy. We're also having these really important conversations about the dangers of that and the importance of disaggregation of data because, it's creating these issues, this systemic racism that seem, problems that we haven't been able to overcome in decades. And we need to start thinking about things in a different way.
Truly. And I mean, that goes into this question of even what do we consider evidence, right? So, when we have research is not objective, right? And I say that, being in academia now and all these kinds of things is there tends to sometimes be this veneer over academic research or peer-reviewed research as being objective and without any bias and whatever. And that's absolute, baloney. There's always going to be the need to question how those things are produced, right? So we have lots of different ways in which research is sort of gatekept, in which, things that get funded or what gets studied and who decides what gets funded is a really interesting question to ask. So, in the case of a lot of scholarship in Canada, SHRC funding or even provincial funding or all these kinds of things, well, those are largely determined in some portfolios, that's determined by what are the current pressing challenges of the day. Well, who decides what those pressing challenges are? You can kind of pull the thread back as far as you want to, but there's always this need to question, exactly as you said, what questions are we asked? Who's producing that evidence? And then how do we learn to evaluate that critically and with great skill? And so this is sort of my central argument around the challenges we face right now is that we have, lots of wonderfully talented public servants. We have lots of really smart and engaged people working across all orders of government. However, my major concern is that by and large, we're not encouraging them or we're not creating the conditions to keep that deep analytical skill in-house. So where once you might have had sort of very specific expertise on a given piece of portfolio in public policy, we had that wave of neoliberal kind of approaches that have happened in the 80s and 90s through new public management. That said, if you're a good manager in agriculture, you'll be a good manager in finance and vice versa. And so we just shuffle people around based on their ability to do project management. But then we lose that deep embedded knowledge that we need around what questions do you ask when you're receiving information from a contractor. And I had someone tweet me earlier, I think yesterday, was saying, working in local government, I try to know just as much about a project as the contractor so that I can evaluate it meaningfully. To which I go, great, why don't we hire people that can do the project internally rather than going to an external contractor all the time? Hmm. And why isn't that policy analysis skill and that technical skill embedded into the way we do government? And there's lots of reasons for that. So depending on the order of government you work for, or the size of government you work for, the resources for doing those kinds of things, if it's a one-off kind of project, maybe that's not appropriate. But for the most part, we've seen things like the great success of the CERB, by the way, is really fascinating to me when we look at that in the context of it being manned and developed and and put forward by a whole army of civil servants, many of whom were not being paid correctly themselves due to the fallout of the Phoenix system, which was an externally built failure of a contract, right? So we know we have lots and lots of evidence that adds up. We just keep going back to the same poisoned well. So how do we build that inside of government in a way that recognizes a broad diversity of what counts as evidence of how you acquire that? And that looks very different in certain community settings. It definitely looks different in terms of when we engage with Indigenous-based research, working with communities who have been made marginal through public policy. And by the way, that's a new phrase to me that I quite enjoy, which is rather than saying, you know, marginalized communities as well, that's not a thing that's individual and endemic to a given community. That's something that has been done to them by policy, right? So let's get the framing right. And so the more we talk about those things in clearer terms, it can feel a little bit kind of like, oh my God, you know, like, what are we ever, we're like, this feels like a major mess, but it lets us ask better questions around where do we put the locus of power in terms of who's contributing to the conversation? And how do we consider that differently in terms of the way we're making decisions? And so for me, you know, a big part of the work that I do specifically focused on rural policy and, you know, just had a piece in Policy Options go out around this that says, you know, kind of this push towards centralization, the loss of rural extension across the country, the closure of sort of specific rural entities, and even the embedding of rural portfolios as sort of sub portfolios or split portfolios in different ministries and different ministers, means that rural policy is largely being written by and for people that have never really had any strong connection to a rural community. And this has problems in terms of what questions get asked, what priorities are determined, how responsive it is to local needs. And if we know that's the case there, well, then we need to follow that through in other dynamics as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting piece for me to see, particularly in the last few weeks, but really and truly throughout the pandemic, is, you know, you mentioned, you know, the work of the federal government in rolling out CERB. At the local level, there's been this incredible willingness to act and undertake new things, undertake new approaches. And, you know, going back to, you know, what has become the political hot potato of masks, with, you know, agencies and provinces for the most part reluctant to act, municipalities have really, local governments have stepped up and done what was necessary for their communities.
Absolutely. And I think so that goes, you know, to this question around where does the power lie? Like where should we put both accountability and responsibility? And I think this is where we're seeing certainly some chafing happen, right? Where municipalities are saying that, you know, look, we are engaging and leading the way and doing our very best to continue to care for our communities and move things forward, whether that's through, you know, redeploying staff to critical functions, whether that's through taking the lead, as you said, with masking, whether it's trying to find a way with transit, all of these core aspects of how people live their day-to-day lives. And largely, you know, what do we see? We saw the announcement of basically the gas tax will come early, right? That was largely been the extent. We have a new amount of funding that's just been announced, with that $19 billion per province, those kinds of things, and that's all good. But I think that's where you're seeing, you know, kind of municipalities saying, look, we are leading the charge on a number of varieties. We are kind of the first point of contact in terms of governing these things, which I think a lot of Canadians don't actually realize, right? They don't actually realize
the
jurisdictional powers.
They certainly don't.
Yeah, between, you know, who's responsible for what and you know, if you're happy about something or angry about something, you know, who's really making those decisions is something, you know, and even the powers of a medical officer of health, right? That they basically supersede pretty much any other piece of legislation if it's in the interest of public health. And that's for very good reason. So all of that's getting is kind of coming to the forefront. And this is where kind of what I've been talking to people recently and this conversation of saying, well, it's not that this has broken anything. It's showing us where all of those cracks and where all of those broken pieces really were in very, very strong terms. So this idea around a New Deal for municipalities that, you know, it's not sustainable to deliver these kinds of services on 7 cents of every tax dollar, that it's not sustainable for this kind of wait and see approach around different orders of government and who's responsible for what. And so needing to redefine that in terms of where we go forward. And this is a great kind of case study. This is an interesting case study in showing us more evidence that argues for those things. But the masking debate, you know, it's really interesting. And I've been trying through this whole conversation not to say anything that'll get me too in trouble with anybody that might want to employ me later. But, you know, it's the challenge here is something that I often talk about in my column with Municipal World these are the moments for leadership. Right. These are the moments where you have to have a clear vision around the decisions you're making and understanding that that balance between the collective and the individual shifts over time. And this is a time where that priority on collective well-being matters the most. And arguably, it always matters the most. But how we make those decisions becomes really important. And this is where I'm quite proud of the vast majority of our municipal colleagues for having taken that stance. I live in Wellington, Wellington, Guelph, Dufferin. We were one of the first. And, you know, this is an interesting part around broader Canadian culture is that, you know, largely a rule-following people is what a lot of people have seen is that, you know, people have been worried about the mask and we're seeing kind of stuff flare up. But by and large, once a bylaw comes to effect, people kind of tend to follow the rules. Now, that's notwithstanding, you know, the lots of really awful stories that we're hearing about people, you know, kind of tearing a strip off of folks at grocery stores or people that are, you know, there's cashiers and stuff. But I do like to emphasize the fact that we are seeing people make those clear decisions around those leadership and saying, like, this is the best evidence we have right now. Here's what we're doing. And I actually Ottawa Public Health had some really great communication messaging around this, was saying, you know, like, we understand some people may be upset. Please channel, this goes to the jurisdictional question. Please channel your frustration towards us, not towards your local wait staff at the restaurant.
Yeah. We're happy to take the heat. It's not them.
Yeah, we should take it. Like, if you're mad, give us a call. Please don't yell at the poor, you know, teenager working at the till at Zayre's. And I think that's a really important part around, like, where do you channel your frustration? But somewhere along the line, and this goes back to, you know, kind of that very first question you had, is that there has to be a little bit of a reckoning. I think we're seeing that with the anti-racism conversation. People are saying, look, like, this isn't new. And the people that have been deeply engaged in this conversation have been doing so for generations. So catch up, right? Like, this is the time to catch up. And you wouldn't walk in an hour late to a class and look at the instructor and say, well, tell me everything that I missed over the last hour. No, you'd walk in really sheepishly, sit down and do your best to get up to speed very quickly. And you wouldn't necessarily expect that professor to, like, be overly happy that your lateness kind of thing, right? And when we're talking about these public health initiatives, it's just happening a lot faster, right? So we're just saying, okay, like, we need everyone to be engaged in this conversation with us right now. And how we deal with these conflicts, I think the way in which we find that way to navigate what this means for the mechanisms for doing policy work or how we communicate the way policies are made, this isn't hyperbole to say, I think that will shape other really contentious policy processes into the future, right? So as we have this reckoning with climate change, with social and economic injustice, as we kind of do those things, you know, the way we do one thing is the way we do anything. So let's learn from these conversations around what it is that made them so difficult. And so we're looking at issues with municipalities, say, well, do we have the legal authority to do this? What happens if we make this bylaw? You know, can someone challenge us based on it? Or do we have the enforcement ability? How are we going to encourage this? And, you know, enforcement is the way it's framed right now. But, you know, a lot of people are saying like the lessons we've got from harm reduction evidence are that, you know, enforcement and shame don't work. There are other strategies through which we accomplish these goals. And then putting that through the framework of our own kind of personal foibles, right? I will be the first to admit that my patience for non-shame based stuff around masks is coming to an end. And that's because I live with people that are particularly vulnerable. So for someone, you know, every time that someone feels the need to not do that and contravene the evidence, they're creating a direct risk to people I love. And my hope is that it's much like, you know, having a daughter or a wife shouldn't be the thing that makes you a feminist. Having someone who's at risk in your life shouldn't be the thing that makes you evidence based on health policy. But unfortunately, that feels like where we're at is until someone has a personal experience with something, the cost of it is so much more removed. So maybe the policy question, maybe the evidence question becomes, how do we stop learning things the hard way, right? How do we stop putting people in situations or encouraging a mindset that says, I have to experience every bump and bruise individually myself before I'll actually learn what the evidence says. And my hope is that, you know, we can get there. It's just going to require some really honest, direct conversations from our leadership. And the places where we've seen that happen so well have largely been municipalities, right? People that have gotten up and said, like, look, this is what we need to do. And people will get on board if they think you're being straight with them. But it's going to be a bit of a battle. And I wish I had the answers. If I had the answers, I'd be finished this PhD by now. But, you know, how do we get good evidence into policymaking is a thing that we're going to struggle with for forever, I think, in terms of those conduits between where knowledge is created, how we adapt to it, the speed at which we need to respond to those kinds of things, and the way that's accelerating over time.
Now we're going to take a short break before getting into the rest of the conversation with Ashley Whedon. We want to thank TELUS Smart Traffic Solutions, brought to you by TELUS IoT, for sponsoring this episode. Smarter traffic data for a smarter and safer city. Discover more at telus.com/smarttraffic. Municipal World's Executive Membership delivers a powerful toolkit for managing Canada's towns and cities. You get the most complete suite of print and online news, plus high-impact communication services and exclusive member content, as well as information to help you and your community stay a step ahead. Executive membership is sized to fit your organization, from 5 to 50 users per membership, and members report saving an average of $1,287 per year just on job postings. It's a smart investment that can quickly pay for itself. Become a member today. Without further delay, let's jump back into that conversation with Ashley Whedon.
I think this is, you know, as you said, an important point in time to have those conversations with the public. You know, these conversations about, well, why bother passing a bylaw, because, you know, you're not going to be able to enforce it. Well, there's so many things that we pass laws for that, you know, we're certainly not in every instance where someone can be, but we know that compliance is higher. We know that these things are important policy levers to influence people's behavior and compliance. And so it's a good time to have those conversations. Not that everyone's going to get on board with that answer, but there is evidence. I mean, there is actual evidence that compliance is higher. And so we can have some of those things. And for me, it's so reassuring to see, the courage of local leaders. Yeah. And we've seen it in Canada, and we've seen it in the US too, you know, in some of these states where, you know, they've said no masks, but the cities have gone ahead and said, oh, we don't care what you're saying about that. We're going to have masks here because we care about our community. So I think we're seeing it's municipal government, local government's moment now, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you on all fronts, and it's kind of goes back to kind of the foundation of a lot of the work that I look at, whether it's infrastructure or labor or innovation or any of those things that I've kind of got on the go at the moment. place is always the filter that I'm looking through this. And so we have two interesting kind of phenomenon here that are different pressures. And so exactly as you're saying, people who are leaders in an immediate location are saying, here's what we need to do, knowing what's happening in our community versus what's right. happening broadly. And so we have, you know, lots of people who are talking about kind of the rise of city states, and that we'll see an increasing emphasis on local and regional government as being the key deciding factors in a number of portfolios. And then we also have this really interesting, uncomfortable relationship around where that sits in a federation, right? So that there are certain things that are done better at scale. What we've seen happen, and this goes exactly the same with municipalities, and how this is playing out across geography, is we've had some interesting economic geographers, primarily in Europe, talking about kind of this rise of populism and the change in these demographics being tied to the revenge of places that don't matter, is how it's framed, right? So places that have felt that they're no longer part of the national conversation, that they're not relevant for whatever reason. So we have to address those things before they become dangerous, or before they swing too far in the other direction, right? So one of those things that we can learn from a lot of the interesting lessons from really powerful activism that's been happening recently is the compelling factor of saying, like, here's the data we have. Here's what we know is to be true. Here are the things that are happening. This is bad for everyone. You know, racism is bad for everyone. It's bad for everyone when you don't wear a mask. It's bad for everyone when we have sexist and classist structures. But finding ways to talk about that that don't further alienate people from seeing their place in those positions. So I think that, you know, that understanding the human behavior side of that and how people react with emotion or outrage to things that they find directly challenge their own interpretation of things creates that tension. And if we look at policy as just a process of getting, you know, good research evidence into a directive, and that's what we do, and we miss all of that, we miss all of those conversations about why this is happening and where it comes from and what might be underneath that, then we're missing the point of doing policy work. You know, we're missing the point entirely of doing government. And I think municipalities, local government, the closer you are to people, the closer you are to a community, the better positioned that you are to do those things. And the better positioned you are to respond to those pressures in your community. We need to make sure that the resources and the ability to deliver on that accountability is also there. So that's the next step, is how do we reframe those things? So I think that there's lots of evidence, you know, if we want to talk about that as a core theme, there's lots of lessons that we can learn around what tends to surface in these kinds of conversations, and how do we bring people on board to causes, and how do we ask difficult questions, and, you know, whether it's, you know, questions about what's happening in long-term care through to what's happening with migrant workers, you know, the foundations of getting to the bottom of whatever problems are happening there start with the same, which is around recognizing other people as just as human as you are, and having the same kinds of fears and concerns and wants and aspirations as all of us do, as basically meat suits with a supercomputer in our skulls. And how then do we talk about that in terms of the very human-based outcomes and decision-making that goes into that, so that we get better at mobilizing that evidence?
Well said, Ashley. That's, I think that gets at the core of the important conversations that we're having as a nation and within our provinces and territories and right down into our communities at this moment in time. If finding ways to talk about those things with people, to engage them and make them part of the process, rather than dismissing them and, as you said, alienating them. Thank you so much for for joining me for this very nerdy chat.
Yeah. And thank you for letting me go down the rabbit hole. These are the things that keep me up at night. And even still, I'm just like, you know, like this conversation is big and rambly and messy. And I'm not claiming to be the moral authority on any of this or to have any kind of idea around how to fix any of it. It's just more that these are important questions that we ask, right? These are, as we're struggling to get through a crisis, we also have to keep an eye on the long game. And that requires us asking these deeply nerdy, wonky questions that are maybe not super, super sexy to most people, but that are really the meat. They're really the kind of the substance of why we do what we do. So thanks for letting me come on and get nerdy with you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I want to thank Ashley Whedon for taking the time to chat with us, and thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more from Ashley, follow her on Twitter at Ashley Whedon. If you found the information in today's episode useful, we hope you'll please drop us a note to let us know, or give us a shout on Twitter at Municipal World. Until next time, I'm Susan Gardner. This is MW Shares. Please stay healthy, stay safe.